It's always dangerous when a speaker begins with an apology, but I do feel like I have to apologize. I'm not an expert on Star Trek, but I was given an assigned topic. How many people are here because of the Sartre hook? Okay, so that many people at least will be a little disappointed. How many people are here a little because of the Aquinas hook? So you'll probably be disappointed too. But I do talk. I get to them eventually. You'll just have to tell me afterwards whether I've done justice to either or to your interests. So across the road from my house, presiding confidently over a patch of lawn on the property between my parish church and the old schoolhouse, there's a chestnut tree. I cannot say that the tree is particularly important to me. Days can go by without my looking at it or taking any thought of it. And yet, if I turn my attention to it, I realize that my experience of this tree is bound up with much of what I know about where I live, about my family, and about the history of my country. I have sat under its shade, leaning against its rough, ridged bark, noticing how its roots distend and break through the surface of the soil at its base, as I read a book or watch my children practicing riding their bikes. Every fall, I have kicked the prickly hulls, drying from yellowish green to rusty brown, that have fallen on the walking path that takes me and my family to Sunday Mass. I have picked up and comforted my youngest son after he tripped, tending to his wounded hand, pierced by the harsh, protective spines of the chestnut's hull. On a few occasions, I have squeezed the chestnuts out of their hulls under my shoe and gathered up the slippery dark nuts, making sure to avoid the ones that have started to rot or to sprout. I have scored these gathered nuts with a knife and roasted them, once in the oven, once on an outdoor grill, and eaten the pale yellow flesh with butter and a bit of cinnamon sugar. I have also ground some of those roasted chestnuts into a mealy, dense, pungent flour and tried to bake with it. My children find the roasted chestnuts tolerable, but hardly a treat, and we all have found the chestnut flour good for nothing but the satisfaction of making something yourself. But we must be missing something, because every autumn, when the chestnuts begin to fall from the tree, I can count on the appearance of friendly, silent strangers who do not know English, most likely pilgrims to the Marian shrine up the hill, stooping under the tree, gathering the dark, shiny nuts into bulging plastic bags. They have identified the rare tree from the road, or passed on knowledge of its location as a family secret, and they will take its prized fruit home for use in what I imagine are generations-old family recipes brought here from China or Japan or Korea. I've never tried to identify the variety of this chestnut tree, but it is probably a dwarf chestnut or an Allegheny chinquapin, or perhaps a more recent blight-resistant Asian hybrid. But it is not an American chestnut. I know this from its size and shape, about 50 feet tall with an 18-inch diameter trunk, bent and low branching. But I also know it from the fact that it is alive. In the hills above this chestnut tree and in the woods behind my house lie dead trunks, decades old, some of them more than 3/4 of a century fallen. They are victims of the devastating chestnut blight that reached Maryland 100 years ago. Wind-carried spores invading from Asia entered cracks in the bark, spreading a foreign fungus that sickened and killed the cambium layer. Without a known treatment or the ability to quarantine, the blight killed billions of this continent's most sturdy and impressive trees, an ecological tragedy strangely correlated with the human catastrophes of the Great War, its tenuous aftermath, and the Great Depression. Words most commonly used to describe the lost American chestnut tree include proud, glorious, majestic. Elegies to the tree describe it as the fallen monarch of the country's landscape. The rot-resistant wood barely decays, but weathers slowly, taking on the brushed pale look of long eroded stone. The corpses of these noble trees are almost unnatural in their persistence, like incorrupt bodies of saints. The chestnut blight destroyed not just a species of tree, but much tradition and culture as well. Lumber was a major industry in my part of rural Maryland. In addition to furniture, chestnut wood, because of its rot resistance, was used for fence posts, barrel staves, and trolley ties. For heavier rail, it was too soft and too light. In Frederick County, chestnut bark was used for tanning leather, and the wood was burned in lime kilns and glassworks. Just a few miles south of my home, charcoal from local chestnut fired the historic iron forge, Catoctin Furnace, a major source of 19th century pig iron for a young nation's industrial revolution, and before that, for 18th century cannonballs for our founding political revolution. I could go on, and perhaps have already said more than I need to make my point. But my point is a straightforward one, that my noticing of the chestnut tree, my experience of it, its meaning to me, is bound up with and directs my attention and memory and sense of identity in expanding circles outward, encompassing layers of private experiences and family history and social meaning, all the way to global politics, economics, and culture. This will make for a useful contrast with another experience of a chestnut tree by Antoine Roquentin, protagonist of Sartre's La Nausée. Near the end of the novel, Roquentin is sitting on a park bench in the evening, and he notices the chestnut tree in front of him. He begins to reflect, and his reflections are much longer than the reflections that I just shared of my own local chestnut tree, so I will only summarize and quote selectively, you can be assured. Roquentin begins by focusing on just part of the tree, its bark, and especially its roots. And he reflects at length on the absurdity of the root, how it is absurd in relation to everything, even in relation to other parts of the tree, how even the affirmation, "this is a root," began to seem absurd. This root, he says, with all its color, shape, or congealed movement, was below all explanation. Each of its qualities escaped it a little, flowed out of it, half solidified, almost became a thing. Each one was in the way in the root, and the whole stump now gave me the impression of unwinding itself a little, denying its existence to lose itself in a frenzied excess. His thoughts continue, and in an exaggerated version of Descartes' experiment with the wax, he begins to mentally strip away the features of the root. And while he is doing so, he identifies himself with the root, coming to understand himself stripped of any features. It is here that the sense of absurdity is made personal, existential, we are now used to saying, and experienced as nausea. "The essential thing is contingency," he says. "I mean that one cannot define existence as necessity. To exist is simply to be there. Those who exist let themselves be encountered." Even as Roquentin begins to emerge from this epiphanic state, to see the motion of the branches and tree in the arrangement of the landscape, the world appears to him still as a collection of contingent existences. Existence everywhere, infinitely, in excess, forever and everywhere, existence which is limited only by existence. I sank down on the bench, stupefied, stunned by this profusion of beings without origin, everywhere blossomings, hatchings out, my ears buzzed with existence, my very flesh throbbed and opened, abandoned itself to the universal burgeoning. The chestnut tree occasions for Roquentin a vision, a philosophical revelation of absolute contingency of existence, its brute fact and inscrutability, and the quickening terror of recognizing one's own contingency and consciousness. As a literary philosophical climax, there can be no mistaking the author's religious allusions, truth revealed by a tree in a garden, the spiritual passage into horrible ecstasy and atrocious joy, an ineffable secret experienced outside of time, a climax of communion with primal existence itself. We have here a lonely, misanthropic atheist's alternative to Augustine's friendly conversation with Monica and their mystical ascent to the absolute. But here, the absence of God, the absurdity of existence without God, is essential to the revelation. The passage is justly famous, for it encapsulates the central compelling ideas of Sartre's existentialism: the priority of existence to essence, the radical freedom and autonomy of the self, the subjectivity of meaning. I want to use Roquentin's experience of the chestnut tree and its difference from the kind of experience of a chestnut tree with which I began to illuminate the human condition, particularly the relationship between attention and freedom. The Sartrean vision of freedom, in my view, is understood at best as an illustration, even an apotheosis, of the problem of human attention, a problem which Sartre, at best, helps us to identify, but in the end does not contain the resources to solve. For those of us who are familiar with the philosophical tradition that preceded Sartre, the solution to the problem of attention is evident in Sartre only by its absence. Paying attention is often a matter of seeing beyond the surface, of making connections, of noticing what is not present as much as what is present. Really, to notice often involves sustained effort. It is, if not properly contemplative, at least often ruminative, and gathers up several levels of cognitive function. To give or pay attention to a work of art, say, involves not just one's eyes, but one's mind, one's memory, one's heart, powers of analysis, comparison, appreciation, evaluation. The words we use to describe excellent noticings are metaphors of extension and texture. Our attention, or the insight gained from it, can be deep or broad or penetrating or subtle or acute or profound. To say that attention can be more or less excellent is not to suggest that there is only one way to pay attention. My attention to the chestnut tree was clearly different from Roquentin's, and I will explore these differences further, but they are both cases of authentic attention. James Wood uses Roquentin's encounter with the chestnut tree as a classic literary example of serious noticing. And these are not the only two ways to attend to the chestnut tree. The attention of a molecular biologist would be led in one direction, of an experienced forester in another. The cabinet maker, the chef, the poet, each would bring an attention with its own distinctive interest and skill. Certainly, philosophical perspective can influence how one's attention is directed. Sartre designed Roquentin's as an existentialist noticing. This would differ from a Hegelian or a Kantian or a Cartesian or even an Aristotelian noticing, and it certainly would differ from a different kind of existentialist noticing, say, by Dostoevsky or Kierkegaard. What did I suggest was distinctive about Roquentin's experience with the chestnut tree? I said before that it was highly abstract, and that it was not so much an experience of the tree as a series of reflections occasioned by the tree. This alone is not meant as criticism. After all, as I noted, Sartre deliberately designed this scene as a vision of self-knowledge, catalyzed by, but not of or about, the tree. Nor does this quite capture the distinctiveness of Roquentin's attention. My own personal reflection on the chestnut tree, meant for contrast, was mostly about things other than the tree. For Sartre and myself, the way we noticed the tree led our attention rather far away from it. Both are, in fact, highly intellectual uses of a tree for the purpose of awakening a kind of self-awareness. The difference between the reflections has not to do with self-awareness, introspection, or intellectuality in themselves, but with the form that these take. I called Roquentin's reflection abstract because it is highly generalized, removed from the physical world, stripped of concrete particularity in history, social institutions, or personal memory. By contrast, the kind of experience of the tree that I described was highly concrete, grounded in the particulars of personal and communal experience. For Roquentin, the chestnut tree leads to an awareness of the self as a bare consciousness, without any intrinsic meaning. My musings about the tree are inseparable from a sense of myself as a father, a member of a parish and community, and a participant in a larger ecological and political history. Each of these noticings and self-conceptions orients the self to a certain conception of freedom. While I have described my own in terms of social roles, historical influence, and institutional authority, I certainly do not experience it as a lack of freedom. Indeed, I experience that very situatedness as a reflection of and the condition of freedom, and in two distinct directions. First, in recognizing myself as a father, a member of a community, a steward of the environment, a citizen of the nation, I am acknowledging many ways in which I have been a responsible agent, not determined or held back by my roles, but gifted with concretely delimited social space within which to perform meaningful action. Second, my experience affirms my ongoing agency by orienting me to various further possibilities of action that could be the basis of future choices. It motivates me, say, to teach my children about their environment, or perhaps to plant a chestnut tree, or research other flora of local ecological and cultural value. It reminds me to treat visiting strangers with humility and hospitality. And when I go camping in my local state forest, and I hear about the ban on importing firewood because of another invasive pest, the emerald ash borer, I am ready to respect and help enforce the quarantine. It is in a very different way that Sartre has Roquentin's experience of the tree illustrate freedom. Roquentin's sense of existential freedom is not one of self-possession and belonging, but almost the opposite, a kind of vertigo of detachment, nausea. Far from finding anything false in this, I think it is important to recognize the reality of this kind of awareness. Sartre's portrait is justly memorable because it is so psychologically plausible. But clearly, this sense of freedom is different from and should not be confused with the kind of freedom of responsible, situated agency. It is, in a way, almost an obstacle to the freedom of responsible, situated agency, manifested as a kind of crippling of the will or a diminishing of the self. Rather than being rooted in and in turn giving rise to a feeling of being at home and a comfort with one's place in the world, Roquentin's experience of freedom is characterized by a profound disturbance. The emotions Sartre attributes to Roquentin in this passage include disgust, boredom, dread, annoyance, confusion, rage, hatred, repulsion, weariness. We are a long way from the feelings I have, reflecting on my local chestnut tree, which would be hard to describe except in terms of gratitude, humility, generosity, reverence, peace, or care. Needless to say, Roquentin's revulsion at the contingency of existence does not open up the world to an inviting realm of possibility for future action. True, his encounter with the chestnut tree is followed immediately by a decision to leave town for Paris. But the decision is arbitrary. It's informed by his previous experience only as a choice, and it is essentially negative. It's a rejection of a place and a project for which he has no care. I've been contrasting two kinds of attention and their respective implications for freedom. Roquentin's, the abstract noticing and existential freedom of an unencumbered self, and my own particular noticing and the concrete freedom of the situated self. But this is too simplistic. For of course, the kind of attention Roquentin pays to the chestnut tree is not purely spontaneous and unhistorical. He brings his own experience to it, and it reflects something about his peculiar character. As I don't think Sartre would deny, indeed, the coherence of his story about Roquentin depends on Sartre's affirming that Roquentin is himself quite situated. And it is only in light of his conception of himself and his relation to his work, to other people, to his town, only in relation to his memories and cares or lack thereof, that his reflection on the chestnut tree makes any sense at all. I will go even further and point out a great irony in the situatedness of Sartre himself as the creator of the character Roquentin. Sartre's message of radical contingency and freedom emerged from a very particular social context. Sartre possessed a quite rich sense of self in relation to others, to memory and history and purposes and values. He was a philosopher, a writer, a public intellectual, seeking to portray something to a readership, responding to social forces, making literary allusions, anticipating political and cultural and religious reactions. Sartre's philosophy makes sense within a certain world of related and sometimes conflicting meanings: post-war anxiety, French Catholicism, Marxist protest, bourgeois morality. Indeed, it's hard to think at all about Sartre and his philosophy without the cultural artifacts and physical accoutrements of a particular moment in the evolution of European and particularly French intellectual life: cafes and lecture halls, books and plays, journal keeping and letter writing, even something as specific as the paper knife, an example often used by Sartre, shows the social particularity, the network of interrelated cultural significance, the historical contingency, as opposed to the absolute existentialist contingency, of who Sartre was. All of this points to what we might call, following the political theorist Matthew Crawford, a particular kind of attentional environment, which is very different from the attentional environment of our day. To drive this home, try to see how far you can get imagining Sartre if he had been born, say, 60 or 70 years later than he was. What audience would he have found? And how would he have found it? Would he give a TED talk? Would he keep a Facebook page? How would his lectures have been received by students holding laptops and cell phones? Instead of writing novels and plays, would he have written scripts for a Netflix original series? I could multiply these kinds of questions, but you get the point. It is incontestable that the attentional environment of America and Europe in 2017 is very different from that of Paris 1947, 57, 67. By the 1980s, when Neil Postman was warning us about the significance of the shift from a culture of the book to the culture of the television, the world in which Sartre's philosophy was born lingered on, but it was slipping away. Postman's analysis of the different kinds of conversation and argument, the different kinds of attention fostered by television versus printed text, could not have foreseen how different still would be the culture of conversation after the digital revolution and the state of constant connectivity. Sartre, with his paper knife and everything else, is almost inconceivable apart from the culture of the book, something he himself knew and embraced. His own autobiography is called The Words, and it's divided into two sections: reading and writing. What if instead of books, this privileged boy had been raised with an iPad and a smartphone, with video games and YouTube, with Facebook and Twitter? It has become a commonplace that the attentional environment of constant digital connectivity is not just different, but one in which it is more challenging to experience worthwhile forms of attention. Numerous commentators, drawing on research from neuroscience to sociology, from media studies to political theory, from psychology to literary studies, have described this phenomenon. The practical manifestations are all pervasive. There are new challenges in the pedagogy of primary education, in the socialization of teenagers, in the psychology of college students, in the communication dynamics of married couples, in the etiquette of a simple business meeting. For better or worse, we are undergoing a vast social experiment in our species' adaptability to a totally new attentional environment, with consequences for human habits, relationships, health, and happiness. The results of this experiment are world historical, and they may never fully be accounted. Indeed, we may have only one generation to consider them before we lose the perspective of any other possible attentional environment. Consider the most iconic artifact of this new environment, the smartphone. Portable, interactive, and infinite in its possibilities, it has reasonably been remarked that the smartphone has abolished boredom. But think about what this means. It does not mean that the smartphone has given us a deep, meaningful sense of purpose and peace. It does not mean that the smartphone cultivates mindfulness, meditation, or contemplation. It does not mean that the smartphone provides focus, insight, patience, and joy. We can say that the cell phone has abolished boredom only in the sense that it gives us a constant stream of stimulation, more likely to dissipate and disturb the attention than collect and clarify it. The cell phone is a device of distraction. We all know this and feel it. Whether it is teenagers vaguely nostalgic for connection with their parents or for trusting relationships with peers, or writers experiencing their brains rewired into shallower modes of thought, or public intellectuals going into detox to save themselves from self-destructive internet addiction, the stories are common to the point of being trite. If I say more on this, I risk sounding like a finger-wagging parent. My son has heard me talk about this a lot. I just don't understand kids these days. But what does it say about our culture that you can actually invest today in a company that researches and implements methods of getting people hooked on cell phone apps? Dopamine Labs promises to turn your app into a habit. It bills itself as an application programming interface for dopamine. That is, it allows developers to design their apps to be addictive. Dopamine Labs and its clients in the market for your attention presumably do not want you to stop and contemplate this simple truth. Not all habits are good habits. It follows that not all habits of attention are good habits of attention. But what is the difference between distraction and responsible attention? Between mind-numbing watching and mindful seeing? Between losing oneself in keeping up with the next thing and finding oneself in sustained reflection? We need a phenomenology of attentional virtue and vice. The power to notice or pay attention to the world is one of our most basic human powers, and like every power, it can be used well or poorly. As we have seen, attention is a cognitive power, but it's not a purely intellectual power. It's involved not just in theoretical reflection, but more properly in all realms of human activity, including everyday mundane tasks. Attention is at least as much a matter of our senses as our minds. And it is involved in pursuing the satisfaction of our bodily desires, our engagement with physical objects. We use attention whenever we act, at least as much as when we stop and reflect. So attention is, broadly speaking, cognitive, but as Dopamine Labs is well aware, it is also deeply affective, able to cause and be caused by emotion. Our attention is aroused and oriented toward things. And it moves us to be disposed towards things, positively or negatively. Human attention is at least as much about our own subjective desiring or being averse to objects as it is to apprehending the content of those objects themselves. If this is a reasonable characterization of attention, then we can say that the virtue of attention would be the right ordering of this cognitive inclination. Where a more properly intellectual virtue like prudence is a matter of right estimation and sound deliberation, attentional virtue involves our awareness being inclined the right way to the right things. To have this virtue would mean that one's interest in things, one's desire for knowledge, is rightly ordered and used. This would mean that it has the appropriate intensity, neither too strong nor too weak. Further, that it would include a kind of steadfastness, or courage capable of overcoming obstacles, such as bodily weariness, that might frustrate it. And finally, ordered cognitive desire would be restrained or regulated or moderated so that it seeks appropriate awareness or knowledge in appropriate ways. We can appreciate the work of this attentional virtue by considering what would happen without it, what we might call attentional vice, understood as poorly ordered cognitive desire. Consider how knowledge, especially knowledge gained through the superior sense of sight, can fail to be directed at what is beneficial, say through laziness or lack of discipline. Consider how our attention can be directed at what is not just trivial but harmful, as prurient interest can lead to lust, or vain inquiry can lead to gossip. Consider how our attention can seek inordinate pleasure, or even test itself by seeking a kind of pain, indulging in the thrill of shock or horror or ugliness. Consider how instead of attending to other people's actions for their good or for one's own good, to seek personal encouragement or offer friendly counsel, we can seek knowledge of others out of vanity or pride or envy. These past few paragraphs describing attentional virtue and vice are in fact a loose paraphrase and summary of two questions of St. Thomas Aquinas' Summa Theologiae. In the moral part of that work, the second part of the second part, the two articles of question 166 offer an explanation of the virtue of studiositas, studiousness, a term which, in light of this summary, we concede does not imply academic study or diligence, but rather, as Aquinas says, any keen application of the mind to something. Immediately after that, the two articles of question 167 elaborate on the vice of intemperate desire for knowledge, curiositas, which we might translate as curiosity except for the often benign or even positive connotation of that word in English. I don't know if Sartre would agree with this Thomistic account of studiositas and curiositas. Sartre did unavoidably employ language of virtue, for example, praising courage, honesty, even hope and joy. And he was at least acquainted with Pascal's description of a habit as second nature. Roquentin expresses ambivalence about this definition early on in La Nausée. Much of Sartre's being and nothingness could be understood as an argument about how to attend to objects and other persons. That Sartre doesn't have the metaphysics or anthropology to account for virtue, that he rejected the notion of a human nature on which the teleology of virtue or even the acquisition of habit depends, may or may not be a fair criticism. But let us at least agree that whether he offered an account of virtue or not, Sartre needs a distinction between virtuous and vicious habits of attention in order to make sense of, say, his examples of the patterns of bad faith, like the gambler in denial or the courteous waiter dissociated from his role. Perhaps Sartre did not feel a need to develop an account of attentional virtue and vice because he lived in an attentional landscape much different from our own. In attentional demands and challenges, the age of the printing press is more like the age of the medieval manuscript than the age of constant digital connectivity. Sartre and Aquinas each occupied a world in which there were natural limits to the vice of curiositas. No artifact of their world had unleashed unlimited opportunities to exploit and misdirect our attention. The natural limits to attentional vice almost seem a condition to Sartre's particular approach to consciousness. Can we imagine Roquentin entering an existential reverie if he had had a smartphone in his pocket? The sense of malaise and alienation, the confrontation with boredom and discomfort, the meditation on the meaning of life, could Roquentin have experienced these or even walked to the park and sat on a bench if he had occupied our 21st century environment of unlimited distraction? There's a further lesson that I want to take from Aquinas about the vice of curiositas, and that is that it is caused by another vice, one of the capital vices, so-called because it is the source or motive for other daughter vices. The vice which gives rise to curiositas, according to Aquinas, is acedia, surprisingly neglected in our culture and not very aptly translated as sloth. In English, sloth implies laziness, but the spiritual vice Aquinas describes is much more than that. The primary emphasis is on sadness, bordering on despair. It is an oppressive sorrow that weighs on the mind and removes the desire to act. As a spiritual lethargy, its failure is more in inclination than apprehension, more in the heart than in the head. At its worst, acedia manifests itself as a discomfort with and revulsion at goodness itself, understood as that which is supposed to draw the agent to act. On the middle terrace of Mount Purgatory, Dante has the slothful souls purging their vice by engaging in a primal action, just running. But we must not think that the opposite of acedia is activity for its own sake. Aquinas says that failure to rest on the Sabbath is an example of acedia. Restlessness, wandering or distraction, ongoing or compulsive activity without ultimate purpose, these are all manifestations of acedia. Whether you procrastinate by lying on the couch doing nothing or by finding other projects to occupy you, you are manifesting acedia. The lie of acedia is the denial of purposeful agency.
Whether by an avoidant and anxious busyness or by a lonely and despairing torpor, acedia is a blindness to or even disgust with the soul's motive force. Subjectively, and as it influences one's emotional cognitive state, acedia actually seems surprisingly close to Sartrean nausea, or the anguish of existential insight. Recall that Sartre described Roquemontaine as feeling disgust, boredom, dread, annoyance, repulsion, weariness. Still, it might be unfair to equate acedia with Sartrean anguish. For Aquinas, acedia is experienced as a loss of existential purpose. If we take Sartre at his word, it is only by arriving at the point of existential anguish, bearing the crushing weight of responsibility for free action without any reference point, that we realize any true source of existential purpose. I don't need to argue with Sartre about this, except that it is reasonable to wonder whether some people have been attracted to Sartre, not so much because they discover inspiration for meaning, as that they find comfort in a description of their own independently discovered sense of loss and purposelessness. According to the research of Christian Smith, American emerging adults combine a sense of purposelessness and uncritical subjectivism with a cheerful libertarianism. We might wonder whether their interest in Sartre, if they have any, has less to do with finding courage to face existential contingency and more to do with reassurance that one's already acquired prejudices are somehow profound and meaningful. In light of our reflection on the difference between Sartre's situatedness and our own, I would like to suggest here a development of the philosophical tradition. Aquinas said, acedia causes curiositas. But Aquinas, as we've seen, like Sartre, occupied a world with natural limits to curiositas. Today, occupying an attentional environment which gives free rein to curiositas, I think we have reason to believe that the causality might often work in the other direction as well, with curiositas causing acedia. That is, the ease with which we can find ourselves distracted today can itself lead to a deeper sense of purposelessness and spiritual torpor. Sartre lived in a world in which the freedom that he thought people needed was a matter of their ability to distance themselves from or detach themselves from their situatedness. I would have been really disappointed if someone saw them and didn't go off. In Sartre's world, the situatedness was experienced as limiting, and very often, or even most often, as something in bad faith. But today, we live in a world in which a coherent situatedness is a particularly difficult achievement, and it's accompanied by an increasingly rare sense of liberating agency. In other words, our new context reframes the question of the relationship between attention and freedom. And it is not clear to me how or whether Sartre's conception of freedom or his experience of the challenges of attention are helpful in our new context. The argument that led me here is a kind of moral argument, drawing on particular insights from Aquinas, but I have not in fact weighed in on the fundamental metaphysical or meta-ethical questions that usually occupy a Thomistic critique of Sartre. My conclusion is more modest, but also more practical and perhaps more urgent. It is that any reflection on freedom, agency, and purpose today requires us to develop an ethics of attention. We must carefully consider the different ways of noticing and valuing our environment, and the different ways our environment directs and attracts some kinds of noticing and frustrates or repels others. Who we are, what we value, our sense of purpose, where we find meaning, how we experience freedom. All of these infuse and are infused by the quality of our attention. And it will only be by serious consideration of the virtues and vices of attention that we address with any responsibility those larger existential questions. In turn, those larger existential questions addressed through a renewed awareness of the virtues and vices of attention, may help us to gain a critical perspective on our attentional environment, to take stock of its promises and perils, to discipline and regulate our use of pervasive artifacts, and perhaps, every once in a while, to make the effort to meditate, to remember, or just to go outside and find oneself again gazing upon a tree. Thank you. We have time for questions.
Comments? I'm thinking about the book by Kathleen Norris called The Sea. Are you familiar with it?
I am not.
Okay.
I will.
She points out that Celia, far from being uniquely modern, was a temptation of monks in the desert.
Right.
And it was called, I think, by some of them, the Noonday Demon.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not critiquing your notion that we need to be careful about what we pay attention to and not to be, like, radically distracted. But I just want to point out that there is a literature and experience of intentionality that's very long and deep in the Western tradition.
Yes. It goes back to the monks. It's usually traced back at least to Evagrius. And I'm not aware of that book, but I've learned from some other French scholarship on this tradition. One of the interesting things about it is the state of the soul is the same, right? The manifestations of it are so different for the monks, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when the monk felt this noonday devil coming upon him, where like he couldn't focus and concentrate and he felt restless and the sense of time is distorted, he would distract himself by doing things like going and visiting the poor, right? Or going and copying a manuscript or something like that. And the counsel to a monk who was overcome with this feeling is, don't try to distract yourself by doing all these good deeds. Stay in your cell and pray, right? That's how you work through it. Whereas I think today, if you found out someone who got bored and went and fed some hungry people or visited people in prison as their way of dealing with boredom, you'd think that person was extremely virtuous, right? Because at least they aren't pulling out the phone or playing video games or something like that. So it's all relative what we use to distract ourselves. And maybe if there is a qualitative difference today, it's that there are many more worthless ways for us to occupy our time. So that, even being motivated to go have a conversation with your neighbor is less likely to be a manifestation of RSA when that was sort of a primary example of a monk's SAD.
Well, to me, I'm not, again, disagreeing with your point, but the monks had armor. They had other monks who faced a noonday demon as well and gave them the advice that
that's
you shared
right.
with us.
That's right.
We are very vulnerable, are we not?
Exactly.
We don't have that kind of armor, and that's one of the points, I think, of your talk, to become aware of the dissipation of our attention, and then to be intentional about how we use it.
Isn't there kind of a whole literature of mindfulness now, and
mm-hmm.
mindfulness treatments and courses?
There
probably are
yoga,
apps for being mindful.
Like, there are. Actually, Dopamine Labs is playing both sides of this. So they're trying to get you addicted to their app, and then they're trying to sell you an app that you can use to promote mindfulness because they know that you're addicted to all their other apps. And as far as I can tell, from their website isn't all that informative, but as far as I can tell, the mindfulness app that they sell is simply something that puts a 3-minute barrier between you and the app that you want to start up. So like you get bored, you pick up your phone, you click the Instagram icon, and then the Dopamine Labs screen comes up and just says, count to 100 and breathe. And you have to wait and you like get through that, and then you can go on Instagram. But I think you're right. There's a there's a vague awareness that we need something, right? Like mindfulness. There are a bunch of TED Talks about mindfulness, actually.
Yeah.
I wasted a lot of time writing this paper, procrastinating and finding out things that I don't need to know. I mentioned, I didn't name him, but I alluded to Andrew Sullivan, who had an essay that came out about 6 months ago. He's the public intellectual who put himself into detox because he saw that his addiction to the internet was destroying his body. And I think the title of the essay is called "I Used to Be Human." And he's very much aware of the need for this manifesting itself in different ways. And he mentions yoga. He actually thinks that there's an opportunity for. He doesn't put it this way, but evangelization, where churches can offer to feed the spiritual need that people are vaguely aware of, but they haven't even necessarily put a name on it yet.
Well, I do remember when the internet first started, and it just seemed intoxicating that you could read all day long. If you have a question, you can find an answer to it. It may not be authoritative or right, but still. And I remember thinking at the time, but if you're always on receive, you never will have time to reflect or make judgments or incorporate it into any kind of a, even if it's not moral, at least whatever your ability to make judgments is. Yeah.
So I
have
another question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
An app idea and question. The app idea is actually quite like the 3-minute delay, except rather than delay 3 minutes, whatever app you press on, it just, instead of launching the app, gives you a picture of the skull and says memento mori. The question is, this seems to be a really important topic, and I sort of like the project. I was interested that you were suggesting we need to sort of be able to talk about the virtue of appropriate attention. And it occurred to me there might be another way one would try and incorporate this train of thought into an account of virtue, which is rather than treating this as a sort of distinct domain with its own virtue, say that the way people talk about virtue is often phenomenologically kind of shallow, and an appropriately phenomenologically rich account of the virtues in general would have to incorporate within it the appropriate use of attention. It's sort of part of being courageous is attending to dangers appropriately and so on. I mean, so studio also tasks would be maybe the sort of most prominent virtue here, but actually we'd have to sort of go along virtue by virtue and work it through. Is that a semantic difference?
I think you're exactly right. I mean, to the extent that it is involved in any occasion where we're sizing up our relationship to the environment, it is clearly connected to all the other virtues. The tradition connects it with temperance, so it's essentially because it's more about desire than intellect. It's about regulating the order of the desire that is the particular kind of desire that is attention. But obviously, it is related to prudence. I mean, you can't make right judgments about your circumstances or about how. Moral principles apply to your circumstances without correctly sizing up the salient features of your environment. So the courageous man can't be courageous unless he's prudently judging the dangers, which means he's got to have... I think you're right. It's going to end up being connected to all the other virtues.
So it seems like part of the problem... is this lack of situatedness that we've sort of lost that and without some sort of an ultimate concern, we lose ourselves in distraction. It seems like one of the differences with the contemporary age is that even if you are aware of an ultimate concern, I think this is like overriding the important in my life, whatever that might be, the intermediate structures don't exist, or at least they're not given to you in a way that you can easily direct all of your mundane activities in a way that conforms to that goal. And that there's this sort of void between where I am and my ordinary concerns and what I think is of ultimate value. It's like in, I don't know, the 13th century or something, a lot of that is sort of decided for you to a large extent. And it seems like at a place like Yale, where you have a lot of privileges and, you know, people tell you you can do whatever you want, that like that lack of those intermediate structures seems to be part of the problem, and not just this awareness of an ultimate concern. I don't know if there's really a question there or not, but that was just sort of what I was reflecting on as I was listening to your talk.
I certainly think you're right, and if I implied that it's only technology that's making us hard to find situatedness, I didn't mean to imply that, right? By focusing on the idea of attention and on how digital connectivity and the constant distraction affect that, I mean, there are all kinds of ways in which political, economic, cultural changes have also disoriented the self. I mentioned Matthew Crawford in his book, The World Beyond Your Head, sort of lays it all at the feet of Kant. You know, you can tell that story. Even Crawford knows it's more complicated than that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
We could point to a lot of things, but I do think the fact that we have wound up with this state of being particularly challenged, even if you yourself have a great deal of confidence in what you're about, you don't occupy a world that's constantly reinforcing the story you tell yourself about what you're about. There were probably challenges in the Middle Ages, just like there were challenges for the monks, but it feels like, by contrast with those worlds, we have a lot less of structural social support for us to continue that coherent sense of self. We have to constantly remind ourselves of it and fight against forces that would either deny it or distract ourselves.
Two historical questions to follow on your comments. If we move west from the first parishioner's invitation, there was a chap named Benedict once who had a vision. And the point of the vision, in a sense, was that he saw almost nothing. And that leads us down a long road.
That
he saw almost nothing.
That he saw almost nothing. Right.
And what he saw blotted out our eyes. And that leads us down a long road to people like Bonaventure and Richard and Hugh, and that whole tradition of negative theology, where the whole point is to discard the particulars, right? And I do suspect Sartre's got a very clear comparison or analogy going on there with the Richard of Anthony's. The vision there is not directed to an entity. It's directed to non-existence. But it's very attentive.
The vision for Sartre.
Yeah.
Right.
But it's very attentive. How would you contrast, then, the resultant state that follows? But I'm amused, and I'm tying this in with 20 years after Sartre, people are reading Ginsberg. They're reading Watts and all these folks who are bringing them the Eastern vision of mysticism.
Right.
And you get Harry Krishna certainly after that. So there's clearly a connection being made generationally, at least.
Right.
From that post-war to the post-post-war period.
So, I mean, there's a sense in which the Christian mystical tradition, you know, doesn't treat God as an entity or tries to get beyond, you know, it tries to lose oneself in something that is ineffable, right? We could argue over whether God in that tradition counts as a being or as an existent thing or not, but there is a divine person there. And the self is lost to everything else so that it can have a relationship to that, right? And it's the kind of super personhood of that, which is, and I think that has, you know, metaphysical differences with what Descartes is doing, and also just sort of personal psychological differences. Sartre starts with atheism. I mean, I'm not a Sartre expert. I find him kind of circular on this. Like, sometimes he claims that he proves atheism, or, but I think he's kind of at his most honest when he just sort of says, yeah, I'm starting with the fact that there's no God. So when the self loses any relationship to anything else, there's nothing. Right, it's just the abyss. So no wonder this is not experienced as a rapturous ecstasy, right? A joy beyond words, but as this terrifying, depressing, awful, right, crippling state. I don't know if I really addressed your observation, but I still I think Sartre is aware of this mystical tradition, but I still think if you're starting with atheism, the mystical tradition will lead you in the opposite direction.
So, yeah, Camus was quite interesting with that notion.
Yes.
That it didn't lead him to what we would call classical theism.
I think that's right. I know even less about him than about Sartre.
All right, well, why don't we thank Professor Hochschild once again.